This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, welcome to the show. This is John.
Today, I'm talking with Natalie Dale. From doctor to writer, Natalie Dale navigates her life with bipolar disorder type 2.
Let's see, just how have you been doing lately? I just kind of wanted to check in with you first and see how all this stuff is impacting you, the social and political climate and everything that's going on with COVID and everything else. How are you able to kind of, what are you doing exactly?
Well, my life hasn't been totally disrupted. My husband works from home, it has moved to working from home, and I'm working from home. So our life hasn't been disrupted all that much. I do think just the overall level of just underlying stress and tension and worry has contributed to, I call them blip, you know, it's not a full episode, but it's maybe like 3 or 4 days where I'm feeling sad, you know, more tearful than usual. And then I kind of normalize again. I've kind of been in that cycle for about a month now where I'll be fine and then I'll hit a little dip and then, or go up a little bit into like a lot of irritability and anxiety and then go back. But it's, you know, and I can't put my finger on any one thing, you know, I think it's just the kind of tension and isolation that I think is probably getting to everyone.
Yeah, no, I totally can relate to that. You said that, I know you just wrote an article for the Bipolar Battle, and thanks again for doing that. That's awesome. I've had a lot of good response from it, you know, like good comments, and everybody loves it is what I'm trying to say.
Thank you so much.
So thanks for doing that. And, you know, when I was talking to you over email, trying to figure out exactly what to, you know, some topics we can cover and so forth, you would mention things going on, you know, about protests and everything up in your area. I mean, just to give you an idea for me, I actually don't watch news that often. I kind of have my wife there because news is so triggering for me. It's really difficult for me to hear things, and it just kind of, like I said, it triggers things. So, I kind of lost my train of thought, but you were going to tell me what's going on up there.
Oh, well, you know, with the federal police coming into Portland, and, you know, I have, I run a writer's group that we usually meet in downtown Portland. A lot of my friends in that group live right there, and, you know, just hearing their firsthand accounts of what's happening is terrifying. And you know, I have a lot of friends who are actively going to the protests, and you know, depending on how I'm feeling that day, I either feel very anxious and terrified or very guilty that I'm not participating. So those have been kind of the currents that have been tugging me back and forth quite a bit. And, you know, on my lower days, the guilt that I'm not participating has been heavy.
And then when you are feeling okay, do you participate, or do you go down there? Or
I went to one protest, but it was earlier on. And I went to one where I felt that I was able to kind of keep away from people, because I am My lithium has caused my kidneys to crap out, so I have
Oh man.
CKD, so I am at a much higher risk group. And my mom has a who we see regularly has a fibrotic lung disease, so she's in like a crazy high risk group. So for me,
Oh, geez.
keeping myself and my family safe is of the imperative importance. So I have not been going to places where they're, where I won't be able to stay 6 feet away from people, but
I think that's smart. I think that's completely smart. I mean, I'm high risk as well. I have part of my lung
Oh,
removed, so I don't even have like the full capacity of my lungs anyways. And then I have asthma, and so like there's other protests that have been happening around here that I haven't been able to go to just because of that reason. And actually, that's a big reason why in the fall here, in a couple weeks, my son, they're trying to open up the schools, and we've decided, I mean, that's been extremely anxiety ridden because, we want him to be around his peers and so forth because he's in first grade, but at the same time, there's so much uncertainty, and I'm at this high risk. And we've gone back and forth, my wife, and we decided we would just school him online, and so that way he doesn't have to be around all those kids. But especially when you're high risk, I think, like you said, it's like so important that we take care of our health, the ones that we love, first and foremost, before we can kind of do anything else. Because I'm a big believer in that with the mental health part, because since I've been dealing with bipolar disorder for so long, as much as I'd like to say I'm always putting other people first, I have to put my mental health first, because if I go down, or I go way too high and I'm out of it and I just, I crash or whatnot, I'm not any good to anybody if I'm in a hospital, or I'm laying in bed for weeks at a time. So,
No, I totally agree. And
yeah.
I think of it in terms of that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. First comes safety
Oh,
and
yeah.
security. And if you don't feel safe and secure, you aren't really going to be able to help other people. And it's hard, and it is a form of privilege. It is my privilege that I can take a step back. And my family isn't in immediate danger. There are people who can't do that.
Yeah, I know.
And that contributes to the guilt, but at the end of the day, you're no good to someone in a hospital, like what you said.
And that's interesting you talk about the guilt too. I deal with that a lot when things happen, that I'd like to be doing, but I can't just because of my mental health or my physical health. I mean, I still work out every day, I'm active and everything, but I just, I'm in that group. So I actually used to get pneumonia on a yearly basis and hospitalized for like, 3 days to a couple weeks or whatnot. And I'm so grateful this year I didn't, but now we have the COVID going on, and it just, I don't think anybody was really prepared for any of this stuff to happen. So,
Someone, I
yeah.
can't remember who said it to me once, but it's kind of since this whole bipolar thing, it's kind of become my mantra, and it is, if a thing is worth doing, it's worth doing badly.
Oh, yeah.
And
Yeah.
at first I
That's
was like,
kind
that's what do you
of.
mean? If a thing's worth doing, you should do it well. And but then the idea of like, if you don't feel like you can brush your teeth, just get up and scrub them for 3 seconds and then call it good. If that's all you can do, at least you did something, and similarly, you mentioned what working out. I've been kind of low lately, and I'm a runner, and it's been 90 something degrees, and I haven't been running. And so instead of that, I've been going for long walks because that's what I can do instead. you know?
Yeah.
And so that's just been something that, I mean, as a lifelong perfectionist, it was a very big
yes.
change.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, it took me a second to kind of let it sink in for a sec as well, but I totally love that philosophy because you're so right, you know? I mean, I wrote an article about it one time, about, you know, something is better than nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like that goes back to working out. I mean, that's the biggest example I can give because, you know, if I work out every day for an hour to an hour and a half lifting weights, and someday I'm like, oh man, I just don't have it in me. Instead of saying, well, then I'm just not going to do it. If I can't do my hour and a half, mm-hmm. I'm just not going to do it. Instead of having that mentality, which is what I used to have, I just go as long as I can. And if I get 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever, that's still a win. Something is always better than nothing. And so that's kind of, I think that has a similar, you know, nuance to what you're talking about, you know? So mm-hmm. I like that a lot. And thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, no problem. And I think I've been trying to use that mentality to tie back to the protests and the guilt that I feel for not participating of, you know,
mm-hmm.
This is something worth doing. It's worth participating in, but I cannot physically be there, but I can buy books about the Black experience from Black owned bookstores. I can try to educate mm-hmm. myself and read. And so I'm still trying to do the things that I can do and trying not to
yeah.
feel guilty about the things that I can't.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The things that you can control or that are in your control, like do them. And then the stuff that you can't, obviously, try to let it go by the wayside. And, you know, that comes back to the whole managing bipolar disorder. You know, I know you said that you had been diagnosed, it was in 2017, October or something.
It was in March 2016. It was like 5 days before Match Day, which, if you know what that is, it's the day when every fourth year medical student in the country opens an envelope that tells them where they're going to spend the next 3 to 7 years of their life.
Oh wow! Oh wow! I didn't know that. So wow! Oh man! And that's when it hit you. An episode was 5 days before that.
That's when I was diagnosed with bipolar. I was misdiagnosed for about 10 years with depression
okay.
first. I think the first time I made a suicide attempt was in high school, but the first time I actually saw anybody for it was in college, where I was diagnosed with depression and panic attacks. But the panic attacks were totally hypomania. They just totally misdiagnosed uh-huh. me for a very long time. And I was very,
oh, wow.
I was, for someone who wanted to be a doctor, I refused to go to the doctor. I had to be
taking
in screening.
why was that exactly? Why were you so against it?
You know, I had a lot of stigma against mental illness. You know, I thought it was all in my head, and that meant that I should be able to fix it all in my head. And
mm-hmm.
I very much didn't believe it was real. I thought, and even up until I was in residency, I thought I was making it up.
Oh yeah. Oh wow. Okay. That's wow. It, and then just so I can kind of get it, like the whole the chronology of the, you know, the time frame. So
yeah.
When you're in residency, that's after you got your card about where you were going
yeah.
for your residency. Mm-hmm. And so in your residency, you were still kind of like, oh, I don't, this is still in my head. And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So to give you the kind uh-huh. of overview, was I was diagnosed with depression in college, refused to take medications or really do anything about it until I was in medical school. and I got cornered by a bunch of my friends and forced to sit down and listen to a pharmacology lecture about how psychiatric medications don't just hijack your brain, you know, how they actually work and what they actually do. And that was the first time, you know, I accepted taking medications. So they were SSRIs. And so I bounced back and forth between mania, hypomania, which I totally hid from everyone because I thought this is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until just before match day that I was diagnosed. And then I didn't tell anybody. I guess I told my husband, but I had a road trip across the country with my mom. She was helping me drive my dog from Illinois to Portland, and it didn't come up.
Serious?
Yeah, 36 hours in a car, and it didn't come up.
And it just... oh, my goodness.
And I didn't tell anybody, and I started residency, and I thought I was going to be totally okay. And I got very sick. I had to take time off from residency. That was the first time I told family, but I didn't allow anybody to tell anyone. And I went back to residency as quickly as I could. And I was basically just in denial. I thought that because I was a medical student and I knew what bipolar was supposed to look like, that I was somehow tricking myself into believing into showing those symptoms. Even though that's completely ridiculous. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sounds like, yeah. Oh my gosh. So, wow, that's, you have some awesome friends, by the way.
I do.
That sat you down and kind of discussed all that. That is so awesome. Like, I think that's just fantastic. You can tell that you're loved, you know? So that's great. And then, so what exactly, you said you went back and you still were in denial about it. What was kind of the turning point that you finally were like, oh man, this is real. I have to, you know, like what was kind of the breaking point?
It was a process rather than a single breaking point, because I kept going back and then getting sick right away. And then I'd go back and then I went back, I think a total of 4 times. Four breaks going back 3 times. And, you know, and after a while, it was just kind of the wearing down of, you know, my friends and family, the people who love me, saying, this isn't you. You are, you know, you couldn't make this up if you tried. I don't know why you would be making this up. but a big thing also for it was that I started writing. Just in general. I wrote about my symptoms. And then when I was euthymic, I would go back and read what I wrote, and I would go, "Holy cow! Like that is one hypomanic email." You know. Or that is one depressed email. You know, it took me 45 minutes to write 3 lines. Okay.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I can relate to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it took kind of a lot of things. And then kind of the cherry on the cake was that I started writing this book that is now called Pathetique. And it's about a woman with bipolar disorder coming to accept her illness and coming, like journeying towards acceptance and moving away from stigma. And it was, you know, the book changed as my views changed, you know, and I kind of wrote my decision into this book.
So it kind of evolved as you kind of went through the process of understanding yourself with your illness and your bipolar.
Yeah, totally.
Is that fair? Yeah. Oh, cool. Okay. And is this, and it's a fiction book, right? It's not like, about you, or is it?
Yeah.
That's what I understand.
Totally, it's the characters are fiction, the events are fiction, but the kind of the theme of coming to grips with an illness and kind of deciding that you are going to change your life for the better, that that was real. That was, you know, so everything that happens in the book, totally fake, but the theme is real. And I had to write that theme.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, that's what it sounds like. You'd said that it was kind of like a therapeutic thing. Like you'd use it to get your ideas down. Right. Did I read that right in the email you sent me that it was kind of like you'd get your ideas down. And as you're saying now, then it just kind of evolved to where it is today.
Yeah. I think it was a process that allowed me to kind of distance myself from my own story and my own world and, you know, put on this veil of someone else and be able to look at it more objectively. Because when you're inside an episode, when you're in a storm, it's so hard to look at it objectively. And so by creating the character arc and, watching her journey and saying, well, that's a good journey, then I kind of realized maybe that should be my journey too. Does that make sense?
That's very cool. Yeah, it totally does. Yeah, I think that, you know, when it comes to writing, you know, or with any coping strategy that we have, but I mean, I can totally relate to writing because, you know, I wrote my book, I have my blog, you know, it's such a way, like when I first started out, I didn't realize how therapeutic it was going to be for me. I just wanted to kind of get some ideas down and kind of help people. And not only was I able to, and I still am helping people, but I was able to help myself and kind of get my thoughts in order and how I believe with this thing, this bipolar disorder and all that, and kind of get my thoughts in a row. I mean, it really is. It's an awesome process. So I totally hear you on that. It's great.
Yeah, no, it's such an important process. And I know a lot of people who journal and who diary. I've never really done that. I kind of stick with fiction, but for me, the fiction allows me space to look at things from a different angle and to process emotions, but process them without having to delve into them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it totally does. No, it does. Because, you know, as we're, you know, talking and so forth and hearing your story with getting diagnosed and how your life basically completely changed, because I know you mentioned that you wanted to be a doctor your whole life, right? Or since you were a little girl.
Yeah.
I was in a similar situation, you know, years ago when I was in college and, you know, I was going to chemical engineering school and then I was going to get my master's in biomedical engineering, or I was thinking about going to med school as well. And this was all before I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And in college, I was diagnosed and then I went through ECTs. I don't know if you've heard of ECTs, electroconvulsive therapy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went through like 55 of those over the course of I don't know how many years, but I basically lost all my memory of my chemical engineering. And, you know, it was like my whole life, it wasn't like when I was a kid, I wanted to grow up and be an engineer, but I put all of my energy into that. And that's the path that I was going to take, you know, these expectations that society has on us, at least back then for me, was, you know, you graduate from high school, go off to college, you know, you get an awesome job, get married, have kids, blah, blah, blah. And I wasn't going down that path at all. So coming to grips with the fact that I had a mental illness, I kind of had to accept that pretty quickly because it was such a, you know, I was in such a, what's the word? I guess I was just so completely overwhelmed with everything because my first episode was a manic episode, a full blown. Mm-hmm. I was hallucinating, delusional. I was hospitalized involuntarily And you know, it was really, really scary, and I had to quickly just realize, you know, I'm not going to be able to do this path that I set out to. It just, this is too serious. Like, I'm not going to be able to sustain what I really wanted to, because like you said that you went back to your residency and then you take a break and back and forth. Well, I was going back to school, and then the stress, you know, would be too much, and I'd get triggered, whether it was depression or mania, and then I'd go back and stay at home, and then I'd recover, and then I'd go back, and it kind of was back and forth as well. And I ended up getting a degree. It wasn't the chemical engineering degree, but you know, I mean, it's scary. This, I think that people don't realize exactly how intense bipolar disorder is, because they compare it to just normal feelings. I mean, the past week, I can't tell you how many people I've talked to that have told me, like, oh my gosh, I have to be bipolar because I'm sad one minute and then I'm happy the next and throughout the day. And you know, I always tell people, of course, you need to contact a doctor or medical professional that can diagnose you. But it just, you know, I think that people compare moods to feelings, and they don't realize it's completely different. Like, sadness can be a symptom of depression, but sadness isn't just depression. And I think all this, does this make sense? I don't know if you agree
Oh,
or
I'm
what. So,
100% with you.
oh yeah, okay, cool. I just want to make sure I'm just not like you know. But I mean, how with you right now, I know, you know, you said that you're no longer a doctor, but how do you feel about all the stuff that is happening with COVID, and the coronavirus? Because I know you mentioned, you know, it's kind of taken its toll on everybody, but do you have any, you know, words of advice, or, you know, do you have any, ideas from a doctor yourself, you know, that could kind of maybe alleviate some fear and uncertainty in people to maybe how to manage during this time?
Well, like you said, I'm not practicing anymore, and they didn't teach COVID in med school since it wasn't a thing. But I
Right.
will say that, number one, I'm actually very grateful that I'm not practicing, because all of my friends who are practicing are underwater right now, and are having a lot of my friends went into like internal medicine and stuff, and so they are actively in the hospital dealing
Oh
with COVID
gosh.
patients every day. Turns out I'm not seeing my friends at all, not even for 6 foot distant barbecue, because they all are high risk.
Oh gosh. Holy cow.
And so, it's scary knowing, my mother-in-law is also a nurse, so having all of these people who I care about who are dealing with it every day, I think that, wearing a mask is such a small thing. And even if you don't agree that COVID's real, what harm can it possibly cause for you to wear a mask? And so,
Yeah, I
as
agree.
someone with people who I love, my grandfather is 90 years old, and is, he doesn't have that
Oh.
much time left, and he's spending it alone in an apartment where no one can see him,
Oh,
I
man.
have so many people who I love who could be so affected by this. And I think, mask wearing is just so critical. And I think that for people who, if you are wearing a mask and you see someone not doing it in your space, I think learning how to stand up for yourself and say, "Excuse me, could you please give me space," or whatever. It's really hard, and I'm really bad at it. And I've gotten literally cussed out for doing it. But I think that,
Oh.
putting yourself first again and saying, "No, I have the right to be safe. I have the right to expect others to treat me with safety and respect." And I think that, at least for me, trying to come in with that headspace has been helpful.
What, you know, something I've been trying to come to terms with this myself because, you know, I've talked on all the social media platforms with people that are for it and people that are against it. And, you know, it seems like the people that are against it, I'm not going to try to make a generalization. I'm not saying that at all. But why are people that don't want to wear masks so upset and angry? That's what I see so much. You know, like on Twitter, I just spoke about this. You know, I put a tweet out there, and a ton of people blocked me because they didn't like the idea that I supported the fact that you should wear a mask. As a individual, I want to protect my loved ones. I want to protect those around me. If I don't know you, I still want to protect, you know, like I still feel love, but then there's these people that feel like it's their right. And I don't know, do you have any idea why people would feel that way? I've been trying to put my feet in their shoes, but it's so hard when I think too, having bipolar disorder or any mental illness makes us very sympathetic to other people anyways. And why you would knowingly want to harm an individual like that you could possibly infect someone with a deadly disease.
I don't understand it. I have heard people say that they think that it's a government scheme to try to prove who will accept putting a chip inside their body. That's the only argument
Whoa.
I've ever heard, and it's sounded crazy to me. Like, it just sounded
Yeah.
illogical. So,
Oh my gosh. Natalie, if I had spoke like that before this whole COVID thing, they would have put me in a hospital in a heartbeat, you know. They would have been like, "Why aren't you where aren't you taking your meds, John?" Like, have you been able to figure out your own triggers with just anything, not necessarily what's going on today, but like you realize, oh man, if I eat too much sugar, it can swing me downwards. Like, what have you found, Natalie?
Trigger wise, it's really related to stress. Stress and sleep. I'm on Seroquel, so I sleep a lot. And if I don't sleep, I almost always go up before I go down, but I have bipolar too, so I don't go up as hard. But if I'm not getting sleep, that's a trigger. Another trigger is just stress, even having to make a decision. Or, right now we're renovating our kitchen, and just the stress of having people coming into the house has been, it's again. So, but sometimes I feel like I have episodes for I can't find a reason. Sometimes they just come out of the clear blue sky. And those to me are the scariest ones.
I'd really like to hear your thoughts on kind of some of the myths of bipolar disorder and, you know, kind of refute those myths. Like, what are some common ones you've heard over the past few years or whatnot, and how you can refute those myths?
Well, the first one that comes to mind is that bipolar 2 is just a less bad version of bipolar 1. And in some ways that's true because by definition, the mania in bipolar 1 is more severe. That is the definition. You have mania in bipolar 1 and hypomania in bipolar 2. So in some ways that's right, but in other ways, bipolar 2, it tends to be like people tend to go have shorter interepisodal stints. Like they people with bipolar 2 tend to transition between episodes. The depression tends to be more predominant in bipolar 2. I believe I was gonna look up the statistics. I can't. I think that people with bipolar 2 attempt suicide more often. but people with
Oh, do they? I don't know
bipolar
this.
one complete more often.
That's, I do know that.
Yeah.
I do know that. That type one they do,
Yeah, and that makes total sense to me. And then another thing is that bipolar 2 is more likely to have mixed episodes, which is what I get. And I know a lot of people don't really understand what mixed episodes are, and quite frankly, I'm still learning.
I've had a number of mixed episodes throughout the years, and they're scary. What has been your experience? You said you've had some, so what does it look like for you?
So for me, a lot of times I get them, I get hypomania and depression kind of at the same time. So for me, akathisia is a really large component. So I feels like I have bugs under my skin and they're moving and I cannot sit still for anything. And I can't sleep. I can't watch a movie and I get really anxious, but at the same time, I'm very tearful and hopeless, and I have no energy, even though I have to move all of the time. So having kind of those things together, it's a very uncomfortable state of being, and also quite dangerous because if you're having suicidal thoughts and you're so uncomfortable that you can't sit still, that's a bad combo.
Yeah, it is. And especially if you are having suicidal thoughts and you have all this energy, it seems like usually some of my friends that have just that have unipolar depression, they always tell me like they do get the suicidal thoughts, but they don't have the energy to follow through to do anything with them. But then with this mixed state, it is scary because you have these thoughts and you can make plans, and then boom, you have all that energy to act on them. And it is a freaky place, a scary place to be.
Yeah, it is. And
So.
I've had friends, residency friends, who did not know that a mixed episode could exist. Because we're not taught about that really in medical school at all. My lecture on bipolar disorder, I mean, in med school was it was a one day on mood disorders. That was what we learned. And so we learned bipolar has ups and downs, and you treat it with lithium next. I
Oh, wow. Wow, I didn't realize that's something. Holy.
mean, there's a bit more
What?
than that.
Yeah, I mean, but in terms of like education at most medical schools, is that, I mean, it's not that much, right? I mean, like you said, it's really a short amount of time in comparison to everything else.
Well, I mean, everything in medical school is kind of like drinking through a fire hose. Every single disorder just goes by so fast. There's just too many things to learn it all at once. And then that's in second year when you're kind of learning the pathology type stuff. It just kind of goes by. But psychiatry often gets the short shift because we don't know the mechanisms a lot of times, and so if you don't know the mechanisms, you don't have to learn the mechanisms.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. Well, what about mental health? Like overall, just general mental health. I mean, do they teach you much about that, you know?
So medical school, you're learning about diseases. You're learning about the pathology and how to treat them. And so, we aren't taught the way, a psychologist or a counselor is to, we certainly aren't taught about, oh, what's it called? The DBT or CBT. We don't learn any of that stuff. That's not something we're taught. In medical school and residency, there's a lot of lip service to mental health. A lot of, oh, you get a mental health day, and here we're going to teach you how to do yoga in your chair so that you can do it in between classes or in while you're writing notes or whatever. But it is not given a priority at all. Especially in residency, people really, really struggle with that.
Even people without, you guys don't sleep that much.
Yeah, sleep is an issue. Having time to yourself, I mean, you work 10 to 14 hour day. I mean, an intern year, you're maxed out at 80 hours a week. And so you work a lot, and it's very stressful work. And I remember, you know, when I was there, we were given 2 days a year. So we had our 2 weeks of vacation or whatever we were given. And then we were given 2 days a year that were our, I think they called them health days or something like that, that we were supposed to schedule all of our doctor's appointments for.
Oh, serious? Wow. Holy cow. Oh my gosh.
Those were the days where you're supposed to deal with your health. You get 2 days a year. And you know, so for me, it was really hard because I was seeing a psychiatrist every week, you know, and I was supposed to be seeing a counselor every week, and I was supposed to be, you know, finding 2 hours a week to take out to see a psychiatrist and a counselor was very difficult. And my senior residents and attendings, they did everything they could to make it work. They really tried, but residents especially, they're just overworked and overscheduled. And if one person drops out, someone else has to take up the slack. And that's, so it can be very, you know, there's a lot of guilt to taking time off. Because if you take time off, that means someone gets pulled from the rotation that maybe they really want to be on. And
oh man.
Yeah. So it
sounds brutal. Jeez.
It is. And you know, everyone goes into it knowing residency is going to be brutal. But it just wasn't compatible for me. And I know a lot of people consider it a very difficult time, and there is, I mean, something like 30% of residents have depression.
Oh, really?
Yeah, at some point they say depression or burnout. I would have to find the study for that again, but that's kind of hard to remember off the cuff. And then when they have that depression, they make more errors because there are cognitive side effects to mental illness. And that was very difficult for me, was the cognitive side of my bipolar was really bad, and it made it almost impossible for me to function.
Gosh, that must have been frustrating too with all that going on. And
It was frustrating to everyone. I could barely read. I had to hold up a piece of paper to the computer in order to make the lines go straight.
Oh, wow.
To read line by line. And so I made a lot of mistakes, and a lot of really bad, dangerous mistakes. And I was too scared to tell people I was struggling. It was, you know, it is not a forgiving environment. And I do believe that most people who go into medicine are good people. Most people want, they go, medicine's a hard life, but they're choosing it because they want to do good things. But the environment is just such that it's very difficult to care for mental health in that environment.
Yeah. Wow. That just blows my mind. I knew that you guys like had to, you know, were always working so many insane hours, because my doctor up over here, they're like a clinical, like a big clinic where they have first year residents, second, third, and then they go through the rotation, and it's like there's a bunch of doctors that teach them, I guess, attendees, you said.
Yeah,
attendees. And so, yeah, and one of the doctors, he was a resident when my wife was pregnant with my son, and I remember him telling me that, you know, he was always working these crazy hours and stuff like that, but I just didn't realize how intense it was for you guys too. Wow.
But it's not impossible. My very first rotation, when I wasn't telling anyone I had bipolar, I was with my senior resident had bipolar. And
Oh,
and
really?
she was struggling with it herself, but she was getting through. And I had another friend come out to me who is a resident also, and tell me that she also had bipolar. So some people are able to make it work. Some people have, their medications work for them, and they can make it happen, or their disease is less severe. And for some people, it definitely can work, and they can get through it. And I'm happy for those people, because I think that it makes them, having a mental illness, you're a lot more aware of other people with mental illness, and have a lot more sympathy for them.
Yeah, I think empathy with just
Empathy.
humanity in general, like I think so. So now you said you're working on your book, you said, and kind of what is the future look for you now in terms of that? Like, I know you're doing that. Are you doing anything else, or kind of what's your plan moving forward?
Well, my plan is to write. And so I have this book. This is my most Pathetique is my most polished book. I'm taking it to my last critique group now, and then after that I'll probably start working towards publishing. But I've finished one other book, and I'm in the process of I have three other ones kind of on the back burner that I'm working on, and also a bunch of short stories that I'm working on getting published. I actually have
Oh, cool.
two short stories published right now, or accepted for publication. One should come out at the end of August, and one should come out, I believe, in September.
Oh, neat. Nice.
Writing is a very different world from where I've been living in, so it's a steep learning curve, and I have a lot to learn. But I really enjoy it, and I think I have a unique perspective, so I have a lot of unique things to write about that are very exciting. And so trying to make it in that world, it's a challenge, certainly, but I'll get there.
I mean, yeah, you totally will. I know you will. You have the drive, you have the you're learning. There is a learning curve, especially with the writing. That's what happened to me too. I actually never thought I would be a writer. My sister and my brother are both writers of the family, and I never thought I would be. I told you I was going to school to be a chemical engineer, it's science, that sort of thing. And then now here I am, and they're not writers anymore, but here I am a writer, and I have a published book and doing this blog and all this other writing stuff. But it's still, I mean, I've been doing this just for 3 years, and I'm learning stuff literally every day about ways to make things better or what to do. It's an awesome journey though. So how can everybody get in touch with you? Can you kind of drop all your social media handles to us?
Yeah, so I've got my website, which is the nataliedaleauthor.com. nataliedaleauthor.com. And then I'm on Twitter, which is at Dale Natalie. And Instagram is Natalie Rose 6627. There we
Okay.
go.
And I'll post these as well on the description so people can connect with you as well. I want to make sure everybody can knows how to get in touch with you.
Yeah, I would
So,
love that.
yeah, definitely. Okay. Well, I appreciate you chatting with me, Natalie. Thank you so much again for chatting with me. It was awesome hearing more about your story and what you've been through. Like, talk about, I'm always the bipolar battle. You're definitely a bipolar warrior, that's for sure.
Well, thank you. And I really appreciate being on here and hearing your story as well. Thanks.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thanks, Natalie. Take care.
You too.
Okay.
Okay,
Bye-bye.
bye.
If you found this podcast episode helpful in any way, please consider pledging financial support to me and my mission of empowering those of us living with bipolar disorder. Your pledge allows me the ability to record these episodes and provide them to you. Thank you for your consideration.